All right, so the story of Jericho, the walls of Jericho. I think this may be really the first time that I'm studying this story, trying to study it in depth as an adult and not a part of some PBS class or watching the VeggieTales version, which is, I went back and actually watched that video. We're not going to watch it today, but I watched the VeggieTales episode yesterday, and for some reason they portray the people of Jericho, at least the soldiers of Jericho, as little green peas who have a French accent. So I don't think that's accurate whatsoever, but it is a very strange story and a very strange plan that God lays out. But the more that I think that we dig into the story and study the story and look at what God is really doing, we'll see how crucial Jericho was for the Israelites, but not just for them, but also for us, because I think we can learn some things about God that impact us in our lives as well. So let's take just a second to talk about where we are, Jericho, the context. So last week we introduced that this is the beginning of the wilderness wanderings for the Israelites, and now fast forward, we are at the end of that. Now they are going into the land of Canaan. So this is 40 years later, that older generation, they've all died off. And others knew that the Israelites were very nearby. If you go back a chapter to Joshua chapter 5, and look at verse 1, it says, "As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted. And there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel." So what God had done for his people, getting them out of Egypt, and what he had done for them in the wilderness, that word has spread. People know about the God of the Israelites, and they know about the Israelite people. This is maybe a quick map for you to see kind of where they are. So this is when they cross the Jordan right here. And in chapter 6 and verse 1, it talks about, or at the end of, I think at the end of chapter 5, chapter 5 and verse 10, it talks about how they were encamped at Gilgal. And so right outside of Jericho. And Jericho is actually mentioned 8 times in Joshua chapters 2 through 5. So it just seems like this is the city that is constantly on their minds. When you go and look back at when the spies go and look out the land, we'll take a look at a couple of those verses in a little bit, but they talk about large cities, fortified cities, walls up to the heavens, and I just have to imagine they have Jericho in their mind when they're thinking about this. So this is the one city that maybe has been in their minds for years and years. And knowing about these walls that in their minds were just so high, going to the heavens. So Jericho is on their mind. This is the city they've got to get through, one of the cities they've got to get through to get into the land of Canaan. Before we get into chapter 6, there's a really interesting encounter, I think, in chapter 5 that kind of just sets the scene for what happens in chapter 6. At the end of chapter 5, in verse 13, so they're outside of Jericho, but Joshua is looking at Jericho in verse 13. "When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, 'Are you for us or for our adversaries?' And he said, 'No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come.' And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, 'What does my Lord say to his servant?' And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, 'Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy.' And Joshua did so." I want you to think about, is there anything in this encounter that stands out to you? And while you're thinking about that, I'll offer just one thing that stood out to me. Was this phrase, "The place where you are standing is holy." In my mind, I think if I'm Joshua, I've no doubt talked to Moses about that first encounter with Moses at the burning bush, and I just imagine in my mind that Joshua knows this story like the back of his hand. He's heard about this story from Moses and knows this whole idea of when God was talking to Moses, and Moses and God said this exact thing: take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And when I think what this angel is really telling Joshua is that this is not your army. This is God's army. This is my army. And I think more than anything, this would be very comforting to Joshua. I mean, yes, he had responsibility to lead the people, to be God's spokesperson in a way, but at the end of the day, this really was God's army. And so by removing his sandals, he was really acknowledging God's presence, and in essence, he was giving in to whatever the commander of the Lord's army is going to tell him. Anything else? What else stands out to you in this story, this short section before we look at the walls of Jericho? Yes?
Well, God's confirming with Joshua what he had already told him. We know Moses didn't get to go over. And, you know, and God wanted the children of Israel to realize he's the one giving it to them. They're not earning it. They're just going through the motions.
Right. Yeah, the only way that they are going to be able to take the city is because of God. They could not do this on their own. Do you have something, Dan?
Whoever this commander was made an instant impression on Joshua. Whatever his appearance was, if he looked like a wonderful soldier or Samson or whatever, I don't know, he made an impression, and Joshua fell down to worship.
Yeah, that's something that this commander of the army, he's described as having a drawn sword in his hand. And this is a phrase that we find only in two other places in the Old Testament. One of them is in Numbers chapter 22, and that's the story of Balaam's donkey. And it says, the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand. And then we also read this in 1 Chronicles 21:16, when David is taking a census for Jerusalem. And David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between earth and heaven, and in his hand a drawn sword stretched over Jerusalem. So yeah, this however he looked, however his appearance, this drawn sword, I can't imagine what that would have been like. And I think knowing that sword was on my side, that would have inspired a lot of confidence. What else stood out to you about this encounter with the commander of the Lord's army? Yeah?
Since the last time we heard that was the burning bush about the land being holy, it almost sounds like this commander could be Jesus. I've read some commentators that felt that way because of that particular statement that you are on holy ground. I don't know that we have any angels making that statement other than what God originally said.
Yeah, that's interesting. It could be Jesus. It could be someone else in a leader of God's army. It's interesting. The phrase "army of the Lord" could be the same army of heaven that appeared for Elisha and his servant in 2 Kings 6 and verse 8 through 17. I mean, there's a lot of kind of just guessing going on right now. But all of this kind of speaks to the fact that this whole encounter with the commander of the Lord's army, this inspired a lot of confidence for Joshua. And that's something that I think we see over and over again, is whoever is leading God's people, God always does a great job of giving them confidence, giving them encouragement, telling them that, hey, you know, I've got this. This is under my control. And in the first part of chapter 6, the first thing that God says to Joshua in verse 2 is, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand." So over and over and over again, God is continually inspiring his leaders, giving them confidence, letting them know that I've got this all under control. So let's talk a little bit about Jericho and the city and the walls. So I mentioned a second ago that this, I believe, was a city that was in their minds. They knew about these walls. Deuteronomy 1, verse 28, talks about the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. Numbers 13 and verse 25, the people who dwell in the land are strong and the cities are fortified and very large. So this is a city that was fortified. We're going to take a look at maybe what the walls look like in just a second. But even more than that, from what I've studied and read, the city was almost itself surrounded by mountainous country. And one commentator put it like, it was almost like it was kind of a theater that it was going down to this valley of Jericho. And he had all of the mountains surrounding this. So when I think about the people shouting in this theater-like setting, just kind of puts it in a different perspective for me. I can't imagine how loud that was. I also saw that someone described this as possibly the first walled city. And I thought that was really interesting because to me, when I think of a city that has a wall around it, there's a lot of talk about a wall being around a country. And to me, that doesn't just come across as anything crazy. But can you imagine trying to go to a city and then seeing walls like this for the first time in your life? I can't imagine that. And no wonder they would have been so terrified about trying to take a city like this. So if you were going to take a city like this in ancient times, it was really, you would take it by siege. You would surround the city. You wouldn't allow any new resources to go in or to come out. You might try to weaken the walls. You might try to tunnel under them. You might try to burn them. But each of these methods really took weeks and months. And if you were doing this, you probably could expect a lot of losses, a lot of lives lost. So what excavations of this site revealed is it revealed a stone wall 11 feet high and 14 feet wide, and at its top, a smooth slope, stone slope angling upward at 35 degrees for 35 feet, virtually impregnable. So it really created an illusion because you'll see there's kind of a lower wall and an upper wall. And so if you're standing, I think this is the next picture, at this lower wall, you see these little tiny soldiers at the bottom. If you were looking up there, you would see the lower wall, you would see the higher wall above that, and it would appear as if these walls are just going to the heavens. So when I could see that picture, this poorly artistic picture that I found on Google, but when I see that, it at least helps me understand, okay, this is why they view the city as, how could we ever conquer this city? There's no way we can do this. And then we also have this part of the story in Jericho. We've talked about this before, about Rahab. But what was so interesting to me is that when there were some German excavators who were looking at this site, and they found a section of the wall that had not fallen like the other portions of the wall. And they found that there were actually some, what they assumed to be houses in this portion of the wall that had not fallen. And from their perspective and from their study, it was a short distance to the hills of the Judean wilderness. So this would have made sense if this was really where the spies were hidden. And they estimate that real estate values would have been low here since the houses were positioned in such a specific way. And so they said this area was no doubt the overflow from the upper city and that poor part of town. So it would make sense for Rahab, maybe a prostitute, to be living there. So that's just something that I found was interesting. They found a portion of the wall that had not fallen. And God's promise to Rahab and her family, he kept that promise. Was there anything else that stood out to you about Jericho or about the walls? Yes, Fred?
Well, one thing is interesting. The site of Jericho measured less than half a mile in circumference and only about 7 acres. So walking around it wouldn't really take that long.
Yeah, I saw estimates of, 30 minutes, an hour, something. I mean, it's not like some incredible day-long journey, which would have been, it couldn't have been too long because on the seventh day, they were walking around 7 times.
Right. I thought that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I found that, it doesn't seem like there were a ton of people living in this city. Maybe a few thousand was it, compared with the thousands of the Israelites. So let's look at God's plan for victory. And when I read this story, the question that always comes to my mind is, why would God do it this way? And ultimately, I mean, this is, it's God's way, and he did it this way because he saw it fit to do it this way. But so the first obvious thing is, you're going to take a city, why not siege the city? Well, this was interesting. So at the time of the attack, the harvest had just been taken. If you look back at Joshua 3 and verse 15. As soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows all its bank throughout the time of the harvest. So the harvest had just been taken. So these people of Jericho had a lot of food. They had plenty of food. So a siege would have been a terrible time for that, because they had a lot of food that they've stored up. Archaeologists found many storage jars full of grain that had been caught in a fiery destruction at this site. So that makes sense with what we read in the story. And actually, within Jericho, there was a spring. So they had access to water right there within the walled city. So taking the city by siege just really did not make any sense. It would have been such a long, long process for them to do it that way. And the other problem is that, I mean, it wouldn't have been seen as divine or miraculous, right? I mean, if all the other times that we read God rescuing the Israelites, he parted the Red Sea, did amazing things like that. But if he just had the people siege outside of the city for months or years, that wouldn't really fall in line with what we see God doing for his Israelites up until this point. What's this whole idea with shouting? This is just so interesting to me. The Hebrew root of this word shout that we see in this story, it means to break or to split the ears with sound. So this is an extreme shout. I think of, you know, if you're at some sporting event and they put something on the Jumbotron that's trying to get you to raise the decibel, you know, limit of your shout. I mean, these people are shouting not just, you know, at a medium volume. They are shouting as loud as they can. The purpose is to split the ears with sound. And then there's this phrase, to shout with a great shout. Look at Joshua 6 and verse 5. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout. And when you look at this phrase and the Hebrew words behind it and the definitions, it's literally saying, make a noise that indicates a feeling or future action. So this isn't just shouting because God said to shout. It's shouting with expectation. It's shouting that I am doing this because I expect something to happen because of it. And in their case, they're shouting because God says, when I shout, then the walls will fall down. And this is a phrase that we see a couple of other times in the Old Testament. In 1 Samuel 4 and verse 5, the Ark of the Covenant came into the camp, and all Israel gave a shout, gave a mighty shout, so that the earth resounded. Ezra 3:11, the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. So God told them in verse 2 of chapter 6, see, I have given Jericho into your hand. And God's instruction to them was, if you believe I've given Jericho into your hand on the seventh day when I command it, you will shout with a great shout. And they did, and they trusted in God's promise. And then this circling around the city. And as we've mentioned, I mean, this may have taken 30 minutes, it may have taken an hour, but really nothing more than that. And then you've got this whole idea of 7 days of circling. And this number seven shows up constantly. Seven priests with seven trumpets, 7 days marching seven times on the seventh day. And we know that in the Bible, the number seven is signifying wholeness. It's signifying completeness. But I also found that the word seven in Hebrew is spelled with the same consonants as the word complete and full. So just something interesting that I hadn't known before. But to me, this is God's way of, again, giving his people confidence. Of, you know, they know the word, the number seven signifies completeness, fullness. And he's telling them seven trumpets, seven times, 7 days. And so in their mind, they're thinking, okay, God's got his plan in place. This isn't some guess of how we're going to conquer the city. God knows exactly what he's doing. And then I just randomly wondered, okay, how many times did they actually circle the city? Well, 13 times. And when you look in the Bible, there's oftentimes you'll see people say, well, 13 represents lawlessness or rebellion. And so maybe it could be that they're, you know, this is God's way of saying that the people of Jericho were lawless, rebelling. But you can also in the Bible see when the number 13 comes up, it's oftentimes the start of something new. Solomon took 13 years to complete his palace. Haman in the book of Esther had orders written on the 13th day of the first month about the 13th day to kill all the Jews. Joseph lived as a slave for 13 years until he became second in command in Egypt. So it may be nothing, maybe a coincidence, but I did think that was interesting that this number 13 appears again, and it definitely is the start of something new as the people enter the land of Canaan. And then trumpets, and we've talked about this before in here, but think about when these people have heard trumpet sounds previously. Mount Sinai in Exodus 20, God gives specific commands about trumpets in Leviticus 23, in Leviticus 25, the Jubilee trumpet, feast trumpets, and then Numbers 31, the war with Midian. So I think these trumpets would have obviously inspired a lot of confidence for them. But they also hear these trumpets with, they have religious connections to these trumpets because these trumpets are associated with feast days and times of religious celebration. So this was, yes, a military undertaking, but at the same time for these people, I think this had a lot of religious significance for them. So hearing these trumpets would definitely have inspired their confidence in God. Is there anything about, you know, the shouting, circling, the trumpets, anything else about God's plan that you just think is interesting in the story that we haven't touched on?
Luke, I was rereading some of this again, but it's also, I mean, you're talking about it's not very long round, but they would have been encircled all the way around it, right? And I think that's evident in, like, verse, you know, 5 when it says that, you know, the people go up every man straight ahead, so that means before himself. So they basically, it wasn't like in movies you see where they break down a section of wall and they flow through the city. They just crush the city all in like that. So it was, you know, God would have known to drop it, and there's nobody's escaping, basically. Like you said, it's just complete encircling of the whole city, and God just
puts
everybody in.
That idea of completeness and, and fullness, yeah. No, that's interesting. That's a great point. Anything else? Yes.
You know, I think it was a good point that was made by the brother on the man with a sword drawn. Nowhere else in the Bible do we see where the word to worship anything except God. We know the angel appeared to Mary and Joseph, and we don't see none of that there. But we also, and correct me if I'm wrong, we don't ever see this again. Capture this land, and we know they did not do what God said, and that led to the judges, led to them asking for a king when they had a king.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, Darren. Yeah, so I mean, they would have had to make some precautions about, like, hey, the wall's going to fall. Don't stand very close to the wall. It's just fascinating. Anything else?
I think, like, this is the first big battle. This is a real first battle they fight, right? So I think, like, you already emphasized that, you know, back in Joshua 1, I mean, he's telling Joshua to be strong and courageous. You know, he says, wherever you put your foot, I'm going to be there with you. But, you know, I think this, doing it this way just set the stage for the rest of their conquest, where we don't see it done this way before. But those people, the first real battle, they had some battles before that we know, but going into the land, but really as they enter the land, they had finished the battle, you know, as he's instructed them to do, but it just, I think, demonstrates and sets the stage that, hey, this land is yours, but the victory's already been won. God's already won the victory.
Yeah. And you would think that, I mean, seeing these walls fall, you would think that no one would break God's command about not taking things. But then you turn to chapter 7, the next page, but the people of Israel broke faith. And it's these, you know, few specific people, and you're just thinking, what are you doing? You've just seen this incredible miracle, but yet you're being selfish. You're not following God's command to not take anything for yourself, but, you know, he had commandments to devote specific things to the Lord's treasury. And yeah, this would have inspired, I think, such confidence and such faith in people, but you still find people that, because of that, are thinking selfishly, trying to get things for themselves. So let's look at, I mean, really, what do we learn? Really quickly, I think God's confidence in his own plan stuck out to me. I mean, this phrase in verse 2, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand." This is a common statement from God. We see this over and over again. Into your hand. Giving an enemy into your hand. Seen throughout the Old Testament. God said it to Noah in Genesis chapter 9. When God gave him all the birds of the heaven and the animals on the land, he said, I'm giving them into your hand. He said it to the Israelites in Exodus 23. Multiple times in Deuteronomy and the book of Judges. And to me, it simply means that God is assuring you the victory if you will simply do what he says. It is in your hand. And in a sense, he's saying you are controlling the outcome and the destiny if you will simply follow what I am going to tell you to do. It is in your hand. Yeah.
Along with that, I was just thinking about how when the angel came to Joshua and they were chatting, he asked him, "Whose side are you on?" And the answer wasn't super clear. It was kind of like, I'm on my own side. So to kind of go along with what you just said, it's about your relationship with him and if you're on his side or not, and if you're going to align yourself with God, not are you the good guy or the bad guy. See Rahab as a great example.
Yeah. Yeah, and even, you know, for us, the victory that we have is assured. And now it's left to us to decide, are we going to be on the side of the commander of God's army? Are we going to be on the winning side? That's our decision to make. God has assured the victory. Jesus rose from the dead. So what do we learn about God from this? I think there's a few things that we can learn. And think about this. I want to hear from you, but I'll go ahead and get things started. I think what's so great about this story is that God wants action from all of his people. Faith in God is not a passive faith. When you look at Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 30, it says, "By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after the Israelites had marched around them for 7 days." And this is a really common thread that I think we've seen in this class about God requiring action from his people. I mean, God saved the Israelites by parting the Red Sea. He could have, if he wanted to, just magically transport them from one shore to the other where they didn't really have to do anything. But he parted the waters, but they still had to walk through them. God provided food in the wilderness, but he didn't just provide it when they wake up and food is in their pantry and cabinets. They still had to go out and actually gather the food and bring it home. God gave Jericho into their hand, but they still had to do exactly what he told them to do. And I think God requires an active faith in us today. You know, there isn't a physical land for us to conquer, but there is a mission that's been given to us, and the mission is to go out into all the world and to preach and to teach the gospel. And that requires action. This is not a passive faith. This is an active faith. And he wants action from all of his people. I mean, God, there was only so much, you know, a small Israelite child could do. But what could the child do? The child could shout. The child could watch the walls fall down. So this is such an interesting story because young, old, male, female, everyone could be involved in this. And I think that's a great lesson for us as well. everyone can be involved in growing God's kingdom. Yes?
We also see how faith reached out to Rahab the harlot to the ungodly people, the same way it still reaches out to all people today.
Absolutely. Great point. The next thing I think we see is this idea of God desiring first fruit. So to me, this is the as John referenced a minute ago, you know, this is really the first battle they come to in the land of Canaan. They could go in and just take everything for themselves, take all the winnings for themselves. But as we see in the Old Testament, there's this idea of giving God, you know, from the top, giving God the first of what you receive. And I think we really see this example here. The contents of Jericho were to really be given as, you know, to the Lord as first fruits of the land. No loot from Jericho was to be taken by the people. They were going to be giving silver and gold, articles of bronze and iron to the treasury of the Lord. And so all of these things that they could have taken for themselves and made themselves rich and wealthy, you know, they would have opportunities to go on and to gather other things for themselves. But in this first battle, the Lord wanted them to see that, hey, whenever something good happens to you, remember that it was because of me that I allowed this good thing to happen. And, you know, the whole idea of first fruits, we see this in the Old Testament, but when we come to the New Testament, that phrase is used seven times, but it's used symbolically. So there's nothing that we offer today that's like a first fruit sacrifice in the same way that they would have. But there is really still, I think, the principle behind this that applies. The first fruits for them, it was the best off of the top, and a reminder that every good thing and every great thing comes from God, and it's a gift. And that's the principle that I think we still can live by today, that every good thing, every good gift ultimately comes from God, and we need to be giving back to Him. Valerie?
Any other good implication about that is that by giving your first fruits, you're saying more is going to come. So it's putting your faith in God that He'll continue to provide for you after you give Him the first of what you have.
Great point. More is to come. God saves His people in a divine way. So even though God requires an act of faith, salvation is still not something His people could obtain just by themselves. I mean, if they had done what they did without this command from God, if they had gone and circled the city and shouted, but God hadn't commanded it, I mean, those walls would not have fallen down. God caused the walls to crumble. And He devised this plan in His own divine way, where there was no getting around the fact that this was a miracle. And then God's confidence in a victory is really all that we need to know. This phrase, into your hands, just keeps coming back to me. We see this all throughout the Old Testament. When God gives something into our hands, we can be assured that victory is certain if we follow His plan. This is kind of similar to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago with God being the deliverer. You know, nothing can keep us from being delivered except ourselves. And to me, this is kind of a similar idea. If God gives something into our hands, nothing can stop that victory from happening except for ourselves. If we deviate from God, there is no victory. Any other thoughts? What else do you learn about God from this story? There's so many things that we just don't have time to cover.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking you have to follow His way, because when this, you know, earlier when the spies had come back and they told the people, you know, they didn't want to, they were scared, they didn't want to go conquer the land. That wasn't God's way. God wanted them to do it that way. Then some of them said, okay, then we'll go ahead and do it. And He said, well, I'm not with you now. And then they went ahead and did it anyway, and a lot of them died. So you have to do it His way, or it's not going to work.
Yep, exactly. Got to be done God's way. Larry?
Basically the same thing. We don't have to understand why God says something, but if we don't do what He says, then our walls aren't going to fall down either, just like they are. So doesn't have to make sense to us. Sometimes you go, why would you march around? But that's what he said to do.
Yeah.
Just like Nahum and dipping in the water. If he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have been healed. So
yep.
Just do what he says.
Yep. Any other thoughts? Yes.
Making application to us today, Matthew 3:8 says, bear fruit in keeping with repentance. And there's just so much we know Christ did example the tree that didn't bear fruit. He had it cut down. So I think first fruits is maybe still a requirement.
Okay. Danny?
The complete way that he handled Achan in the situation is scary. That doesn't give you reverence and fear for God. I don't know about what we can do that to ourselves, just like Achan did that to himself. We have to be guard our lives continually every single minute.
Yep. Great thought. I just want to leave you with this thought. The next time God visited Jericho, so Jericho comes up all throughout the Old Testament again and again, but to my knowledge, the next time God visits Jericho is when Jesus visits Jericho. So if you look at Mark chapter 10 and verse 46, they came to Jericho and Jesus heals blind Bartimaeus. And you'll notice in verse 46, it says, as he was leaving Jericho. So here Jesus is reaching out to who society would view as an outsider and an outcast, but Jesus treats him with love and with compassion. And then you look at Luke chapter 19, again we see Jesus, verse 1, it says, he entered Jericho, and there was a man named Zacchaeus, a tax collector, who no doubt would have been an outcast, someone on the outside, but yet Jesus goes and dines in his home. And so I think there's so many interesting comparisons we could get into between this first time God visits Jericho and how the Israelites eventually, you know, find their way towards Jerusalem and the Promised Land. And here Jesus is going from Jericho up to Jerusalem. And there's just so many fascinating kind of comparisons you can make there. But what I think about is just the fact that, you know, and that God saves Rahab, this prostitute. He remembers his promise with her, remembers what she did for the spies of the Israelites. So he's helping this outcast, someone that would have been seen as just a horrible, horrible person. And then in Jesus' time, he goes to Jericho, and here God again is treating an outcast with respect in that same area, and the same respect and same love that we see him treat Zacchaeus. So that's just kind of an interesting note that I came across. But for Wednesday, think about this question. How should we walk with God through the unexpected? And I believe Mark is going to be leading that class. Any final thoughts about Jericho, about the walls falling down? Yes?
At the conclusion of the story, Joshua curses the person who rebuilds the city. And at least what's running through my head, you know, I think of Sodom and Gomorrah, and it being explained kind of beforehand, their iniquity, and the city of Nineveh, where Jonah's sent, and their iniquity being explained. But I wonder what set Jericho apart, not only for it to be conquered, because, you know, the Israelites are being given the land of Canaan and their inheritance along the Jordan, but why would Joshua turned to the people and say, of this land, you know, we're not rebuilding it. This isn't going to become a staple along Israel that other cities would.
Yep.
So it's just, for me, it's a question. I look for an answer kind of throughout the process of this class. And if anybody has an answer or kind of an idea, that it was to me one of the more interesting aspects is just the conclusion of Jericho.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you. In 1 Kings 16, at the end, we do see that this curse happens to someone. There was a king that came and rebuilt Jericho, and it says it came at the cost of his youngest son. So the curse happened, but why? I don't know. Interesting question. All right, thank you all so much for your attention and comments.